climate crisis is already happening now. It's not a thing of the future anymore. There are different parts of the world that are already impacted. And we're clearly on this Titanic where, if you remember the movie, there were all these people who were in the third class. They were the ones. They would never get a lifeboat. This boat is clearly drowning and we have to do more. And clearly we are not all in the same position. We're all on different classes of the boat. So there's clearly much, much differences. That was kind of the point of calling out and saying decolonize the climate movement.
Tony, thank you so much for joining me on the Dissents podcast.
Thank you for inviting.
Yeah, we both came together to talk about climate change, climate justice, and the question of racism. Of course, in a racist society, the issue of climate change is also tinted by racism. But you actually say that the climate movement in itself is racist. And these should be the guys that know better, right? So, Tony, let's cut right to the chase. How racist is the climate movement?
I always like to say, to answer that question, I always like to say the climate movement is only as racist as the rest of the society. Mm-hmm. Because the movement is part of the society today, but also on the other hand, the movement criticizes the society for the crisis we are in, right? For not taking the right actions. So when the movement is talking about changing the society, then they have to do better than the rest of the society. And that is where I hold them accountable. I mean, hold myself because I consider myself as part of the climate movement. So it's kind of, yeah, that's why I'm like, we have to do better. This is unacceptable. So we need to change.
Yeah. And with that, a warm welcome to all our listeners out there. Thank you for joining us on the Dissent Show. My guest this week is Tony Noshin, economist and degrowth activist. Tony, you're actually quite known in the climate movement, and we're talking about racism within the climate movement. Where did you yourself experience racism within the movement?
Yeah, this is actually a bit interesting for myself, because when I started getting involved with the movement back in 2018-19, so I first started with the degrowth community, right? So I always say I'm a climate justice and degrowth activist. And with the degrowth community, I actually never felt like personally, I felt very welcome. And then for me, I never felt anything different, like the regular things that you would encounter as a person of color when you're walking down the street in Germany. So you get often, of course, and you get used to it. These are these weird stares. There would be some older aunts who would be mean with you, or some just random skinhead guy who would be shouting at you and trying to punch you. So I think this is like, of course, as person of color, our lives are more adventurous and more fun.
That's quite a description for shitty things like that.
Yeah, it's more happening. It's not as boring. It's more happening. So I have had terrible experiences of like, twice dealing with some men. And there was one time I was in a bus. It was a long distance bus. I was traveling back from Malmo to Berlin, and there were seven person who were all dressed in black and wearing specific jewelries, and they were all had shaved head, and they all kind of seven men together were kind of bullying me for a really long time. And the amazing thing is no one else on the bus thought that, oh, we could do something. Maybe we should try to intervene. So those are the experiences that I've had. And these are not the people from the climate movement, right?
Yeah, sure.
And somehow for that, I always had a different, I don't know, like a distance. I could always shake it off. I'm like, yeah, of course, these people don't know any better. This men, these funny, poor people, they grew up somewhere and without not a lot of exposure to a lot of different knowledge. So that was my way of looking at it and shake it off, kind of.
Yeah, but as you already said, Tony, these skinhead fascist type of guys, they aren't like the typical climate justice warriors. And you specifically wrote an article, I link it in the show notes, by the way, where you say that the climate movement needs to address its racism, the racism within its structures. So what about that?
I feel oftentimes the people who are more engaged with the NGO, so I kind of specifically blame the NGOs a bit more than the movement itself. I've found a lot of the activists on the ground are much more open and grounded and like open and reflected. But I often found the people who are more privileged, who have a more higher paid job or more power position in different NGOs, those are the ones somehow also carry a lot of this weird view of white people being better, or this white people needing to save the world. And then they carry that very strongly also in the environmental and climate movement, and they kind of subconsciously or consciously try to, yeah, perpetuate that and then keep on creating those scenarios.
In the article you mentioned, you also wrote about an episode where you were actually cut from a picture, something very similar that happened to the Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe tell us about this story a bit, because she was cut from the picture by a press agency. There you can say, okay, they're not as engaged with topics of climate change and racism and the connections in there. But this was actually a Greenpeace photo.
Yes.
Where you were cut from. So maybe tell us a bit about this episode.
Yeah, it was a bit weird in many ways. I was not exactly cut. The funny thing is it was this specific action. It was just four or five of us. It was Catherine Henneberger, Luisa Neubauer, me, and two other activists as well. And it was just a small action. It was very specific to protest the Datteln 4 going on grid that day. After finishing the action, I was returning and I was in the car. And then I saw this tweet, being tagged in a tweet. And then I went onto the tweet. And then I just saw there were pictures and there were everyone else except me. So it was a bit weird for me, but then why do you tag me? What I felt like, you know, if you have a birthday party and you have 6-7 friends invited, and then if you post all the pictures except one friend, it would feel like, oh, I don't like that friend or something. No, it would just feel a bit weird, like, why do you don't post pictures of everyone? So it was just kind of that. And I didn't think much about it. And then one of my friends, I was just laughing. I shared the tweet with this friend and I said, oh, looks like Greenpeace forgot that I was there today. And I was just making joke about it. And then this friend, she was, I think it helped as well. She was like, this is not okay, Tony. You should say something like, this is not cool. Why did they do that? And especially, of course, we could not care, but also considering the fact that you were the only woman of color in that action, they should have rather paid specific attention to make sure that you are included rather than that it's the opposite. So yeah, even if it's a mistake, it's not a cool mistake. It's just very weird. And that kind of I ended up thinking, and it was not easy. Like, writing this article or going through this process was very, very difficult, because whenever you talk about something, it's like, you know, it's like, for example, there was once in your high school, you were in grade 3 and there were some nasty kids that bullied you and you don't want to talk about that, right? Like, you've grown up as a man and then it's not a pleasant memory that you would try to share with your friends. Like, yeah. Oh yeah, when I was in grade 3, this mean kids bullied me. So it's something like that. It's not fun. It's not nice to talk about shitty stuff. It's not cool. And it's, no one wants to do that. Like, we have this weird tendency in the society, right? Like, whenever a woman tries to talk about sexual oppression, like, she faces harassment, she faces, everyone is like, she just wants some attention. No, I mean, no one ever wants to. It's very, very difficult and it's not fun. So it's the same. Like, whoever is trying to talk about some kind of harassment and oppression, it's never an easy thing. It's very difficult. Yeah. So for me, I think I had a lot of amazing friends and people who believed in me and who support. Because I was already part of the movement for so long. So I have a very, like, everybody knows me, and already before that, inside the movement, everybody kind of knew me and all that. So even then it was difficult for me to think about speaking up, especially as big NGO as Greenpeace, right? They are one of the largest institution for the climate movement or the climate work. So it was not easy. It was very difficult for me to really then decide and write the article and then publish it. So it was a very long, difficult journey. But I think on the other side, when I look back, I think it has really created a change. I feel like it was kind of a very important point in last year to make room for specific discussion. And that I feel like is like the small stones that starts rolling and that creates a bigger avalanche. So in that way, I kind of feel that it has been meaningful or worth it to do that work.
You're calling out, Tony, and saying the climate movement needs to decolonize itself. Maybe you can explain a bit more what that means from your perspective, to decolonize the climate movement.
Yeah, I think what happened for a while at the beginning when Fridays started or Extinction Rebellion started was more about our future, right? Like Fridays for Future, save our future, or kind of telling the older generation that you're not doing enough for our future. But what it completely disregards, that the climate crisis is already happening now. It's not a thing of the future anymore. There are different parts of the world that are already impacted. And actually, already for the last 10, 20 years, there has been different marginalized communities who have been fighting already. It's a very much life-threatening issue in South America to be an environmental activist. People get killed. Like each year, more than 200 people, 200 activists gets killed in Latin America. So within this framework, within this, at the beginning, it felt like the whole climate movement here in Global North, in Germany, in Sweden, like they were completely unaware of this perspective. So it started more like, oh, we are trying to save the world, listen to us. And it was all about how our future at this point, like the future of these kids in Global North, is in danger. And it completely didn't take into consideration of what's already happening and what has been happening last 10, 20 years. And these privileges that they are entitled to, and they were completely blind to their own privileges, like didn't even see what the climate crisis is built on, how their whole lifestyle is at the root of the this climate crisis that's we are facing today, and it's coming back to us now in some way. And unless we make that connection and we acknowledge that people in the Global South has been already fighting, there are different communities in the Pacific Islands, they are going down the water, but they have been fighting. And there are in Africa, people have been fighting against Shell's toxic projects. So this has been in different communities in the front lines. They have been fighting against fossil fuel projects for the last 20, 30 years already. And without those kind of knowledge and without knowing how this lifestyle in Global North or these big businesses, all these corporates, they all have their roots in Global North, and how this is all connected and supports this privileged lifestyle, without that acknowledgement, then if you start saying, oh, save our future, we also have a right, then it's very privileged and blind and unfair. And that's why it's also still very, then it's colonial. So that's the point of calling out on that and saying, hey, first of all, be aware of what's happening globally. Second of all, be aware of your privileges. And third of all, then acknowledge your legacy, acknowledge what you're saying, because if you being so privileged are also finally seeing that this is a problem, just imagine what's happening outside for the rest of the world. They're already facing it. That was kind of the point of saying, calling out and saying, decolonize the climate movement and start seeing it and connecting the fights.
Yeah, what you just said kind of reminded me of this metaphor that's passed on in the climate movement and climate debate in general. It kind of goes like, we are all in the same boat when it comes to climate change. And
clearly,
this disregards like the way climate change is affecting us differently.
Absolutely.
When it comes to race, gender, class, and also the nation we are born in. And that's what you mentioned already. So how do you think about this picture? We are all in the same boat. And what metaphor would you prefer personally?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is exactly like if you're on the same boat, we're clearly on this Titanic, where if you remember the movie, there were all these people who were in the third class. They were the ones, right, they would never get a lifeboat. They were the ones who were forced and pushed. And then the elites were the ones who were first getting the boats, and this white man who are running to the boats pretending to save the woman and kids. Like then it's kind of that messy, chaotic situation. So yeah, first of all, this boat, for clearly where we are is clearly drowning, and we have to do more. And clearly we are not all in the same position. We're all on different, how do you call it, classes of the boat. So there's clearly much, much differences the way we are living on this boat. And I also as well, like how then we are responsible of the crisis of the boat is sinking.
It's kind of, well, the Global North at the top is kind of discussing whether hydrogen or electric cars should be the future. Like the classes down below are already like drowning, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it's so unfair. And again, so then for a movement that claims to be a people's movement cannot disregard people's struggles, no?
But the interesting thing, I guess, and that comes back to when you say decolonize the climate movement, is that even within the climate movement, you have persons that are not reflecting these issues, I think, because in Konstanz at one Fridays for Future event, Volker Quaschning, he's a researcher, talked about the issue of migration in connection to climate change. And it was like formulating and saying like, yeah, we need to become climate neutral and stuff like that, because otherwise we will be overrun kind of by migrants. So maybe you didn't mean it like that, but it came across as if the fight against climate change is connected to making our borders safe and preventing freedom of movement, which to me is kind of a nationalist narrative.
Yes, absolutely.
So what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's like another kind of a terrible, terrible point, and what people often don't see. Yeah, actually, good that I've been thinking of writing something about it already for a while, because even many climate activist people, and we know famous people like Jane Goodall or Devin Attenborough, they even end up kind of talking about this population and how as if the people who has bigger population are the ones responsible for climate crisis. And it is absolutely bullshit. And not only bullshit, it's also wrong, because first of all, it completely shifts the whole responsibility to the ones who have least responsibility of the climate crisis. Because now research shows, all the data, this Oxfam research, the richest 10% of the world is responsible for 80% of the pollution, the carbon emission that is responsible for the climate crisis. So if we all were living like maybe people in the way the countries, people in West Africa lives, we would be fine. We could be even more people. We wouldn't be having any climate crisis. You know, so then this, the way that the discussion goes, and I was thinking, like, why does it that way? Why often we fall to this victim? So one thing is the people who could speak or whose voices get heard are the ones often who are part of these privileged groups. And, you know, nobody wants to take their own responsibility. No one would want to say, you know what, the way I live my life, actually, I finish up carbon budget of one Ghanaian person in 3 days, what a person who lives in Ghana uses in a year. Nobody wants to say that, right? For example, a German person's carbon footprint is 17.5 times higher than an average Bangladeshi person's carbon footprint. So here, if you look into that, population is not the reason for the climate crisis. And this is not also something at the root of the problem. We are already, actually, we see that by mid of the century, our world population will already be picked. By the end of this century, we would already be decreasing the way our population trend is now. And in many countries, actually, the population is, we are already in a downward slope. So, and on top of that, if you look into this data of what is the root cause of the climate crisis, population is not, it's a far, far away. It's not even the reason. And then the people are not even responsible. And then the way you talk about it, it makes like, oh my God, these zombies are coming at us and we have to do something about it. And then it kind of uses this right wing tendency. And then I think that's very wrong. And it's actually shooting ourselves in the foot, because as all the IPCC reports say, that this climate crisis requires unprecedented levels of cooperation. No one can get out of this crisis alone, and we won't be getting out of this by fighting against each other. So what we really need, we would need to start talking at the right, like the truth and a correct narration, and really taking up the responsibility instead of shifting it somewhere else. And then when we talk about that, it really helps this eco-fascist and this, like, what they call, like, the people who uses examples of ecological breakdown as a way to justify oppressive regimes, like, for example, border control, or why we should have more military, or this kind of right-wing thoughts. And that's absolutely wrong. And we have to right away fight, I think, very strongly from the beginning. Yeah, destroy these discussions at the root. And good that you, yeah, cool that you mentioned that. Yeah, this is, and the problem is in the climate movement, it's very, still not everybody sees it very clearly. And it's, yeah, as I was saying, it's very easy to not see for the people who are kind of at the core of it or responsible in some ways.
Ja, Leute, mal wieder eine Folge Dissens auf Englisch. Ich wollte Tony unbedingt in der Show haben und ich hoffe, ich schließe mit Interviews in englischer Sprache niemanden aus. Ich kriege dazu unterschiedliche Aussagen. Viele Leute wünschen sich mehr Interviews in englischer Sprache mit internationalen Gästen und viele wünschen sich, dass ich das weniger mache, weil es schwierig ist, englischen Interviews zu folgen, weil sie keine Muttersprachler etwa sind. Ja, schreibt mir gerne eure Meinung dazu. Mir fehlt leider gerade die Kapazität, um dieses Interview für euch zu übersetzen. Wenn es da draußen Leute gibt, die jetzt zuhören und die gut im Übersetzen sind von englischen Interviews, schreibt mir eine Mail an dissenspodcast@posteo.de. Ich zahle schlecht, aber ich zahle. Ja, und an dieser Stelle möchte ich auch kurz all meinen Fördermitgliedern danken. Schön, dass ihr Dissens monatlich mit eurem Geld supportet. Das macht möglich, dass ich hier gute Ideen mit coolen Leuten wie Tony für alle da draußen umsonst zur Verfügung stelle. Und wenn du das hier hörst und noch nicht dabei bist, dann überleg dir doch, ob du nicht auch Fördermitglied werden kannst. Es geht schon ab 2 Euro im Monat. Ja, und unter allen Mitgliedern und allen Neumitgliedern verlose ich passend zu dieser Folge das Buch Klimax von Andreas Malm, dem schwedischen Humanökologen, der auch ziemlich aktiv ist in der Klimabewegung. Einige von euch werden ihn bestimmt kennen. Übrigens, Andreas Malm werde ich bald zusammen mit Tachio Müller im Podcast haben. Es wird natürlich auch auf Englisch sein, aber diese zwei Schwergewichte der Klimabewegung mal zusammenzubringen, das geht dann halt nur auf Englisch. Ja, alle Infos, wie ihr mitmachen könnt bei Dissens, die gibt es in den Shownotes und auf dissenspodcast.de. Und jetzt geht's weiter mit Part 2 des Interviews mit Tony. Yeah, well, you're listening to the Dissens podcast. My guest is Tony Noshin. She's an economist and climate activist. Tony, I read about you that you grew up in Dhaka in Bangladesh. Maybe you can tell our listeners a bit, how did that shape your path to climate activism?
I grew up in Bangladesh and I was involved with politics from a very early age. My whole family was a very political family. I often joke that we are third generation leftists. So when I was in high school, grade 6, 7, I was involved with the anti-privatization movement in Bangladesh. There was this whole part of the World Bank IMF structural adjustment reform that said the whole health sector, education sector must be privatized. And that meant people who could not afford to pay a lot won't have access to these very basic services. And there was a big movement against this kind of privatization efforts of the government. And I was part of those movements. So I think this sense of coming together, organizing, the power of organizing, coming together and protesting around policies that are harmful for people was in me from that early age. And much, much later in 2017, when I learned about the climate crisis and what's driving it, I think that's how, for me, then I ran again to organizing, to mobilizing with others and realize the need to come together and raise voices. I would say that's how it affected my climate activism later on in life.
For years, Tony, you organized a protest to save the biggest mangrove forest of the world in Bangladesh. It's called Sunjabas. Tell us a bit about that episode and are you still involved in that fight?
So the movement to save Sundarbans started in 2011 back in Bangladesh, soon after the government of Bangladesh and government of India declared that they're going to build this power plant. It's a joint venture. So the citizens' movement was very vigilant. It started early on. People came together, started collecting signatures, started doing different forms of protest. And over the years, the protest grew and grew. And I was, of course, a part of that when I was back home. I got more involved internationally in 2016 when I was here in Germany. We saw some news that back in Dhaka there was a strike for half day, and my friends who are part of this protest, I saw pictures of them getting brutally beaten by police. So the government started oppressing and cracking down the movement. And when we from here saw this news, we were really, what can we do from outside? We were like, okay, here you cannot beat us up, right? And then we started with different diaspora living abroad in different countries. We started mobilizing and trying to raise awareness around this issue. That we connected with international NGOs. We reached out to them. We wrote to different groups. So that's how I got involved. And the power plant is still being built despite this very strong protest from home and abroad. There is a German company that is involved with this, the building of this power plant, that is called Fischner. And we are addressing them. And they are still also involved with another power plant, building of another power plant. So we have been trying to address that and kind of push. The movement is still ongoing, but in a different scale at the moment.
In 2016, you came to Germany, and today you work for the climate NGO Urgewald. What is Urgewald and what do you guys do?
Yeah, Urgewald focuses on trying to demystify the black box that is the finance sector, because fossil fuel is driving today's climate crisis.
And there are, so just not only fossil fuel companies that are doing the business, the problem is there are a lot of government pension funds, a lot of different banks who are investing in them. The idea Ugewald has is kind of making it clear who is investing, where the money is going, and kind of asking all these different agencies to stop financing fossil fuel businesses. So move the money away, cut the money from fossil fuel. And that is the way to kind of dismantle one of the very crucial supporting pillars of the fossil fuel business. That's the model Ugewald uses, or that's the approach of divestment work. And Global Coal Exit List, I was a researcher for Global Coal Exit List, and for that, we look into different companies who are benefiting from coal businesses, and there are certain criteria, and we list those companies in this list, and we ask all investment, different firms, government pension funds, different banks, to not put any money into the company that are in the list. That is the approach of Global Coal Exit or the divestment work.
Tony, I wanted to talk a bit more in depth about the connection of the climate crisis and racism. You and others use the term environmental racism to highlight the connection there. Maybe you can explain a bit more what environmental racism, or Umweltrassismus for our German listeners, what that is, and give us some examples.
When we talk about environmental racism, the idea is that everyone, like we as humans, everybody has the equal rights to benefit from environmental resources or be protected from like environmental degrading catastrophic events. So, for example, we all have the same right to clean air. We all have the same right to be able to, if there is a big forest, then to be able to have access to this forest and enjoy what the forest has to offer. And then environmental racism talks that how, based on race, based on sex, based on class, people have different powers, and using that power then to actually disproportionately make others pay or suffer from these environmental catastrophic things, or only hoard the benefits from the environment that everybody should get, but instead just the only very few gets it and then the rest doesn't. So, for example, the easy example would be back in the days when there was a lot of coal, and then the coal mines, and it was specifically planned that the coal factories would be in the poor regions because the rich didn't want to get this dirty coal, like air. They didn't want to suffer, right? They wanted to have cleaner air. So they would plan that all these coal factories would be in the places where the poor people live, and specifically even maybe where the black. So it was in the case of USA, there were this one specific case that is often considered the root of environmental racism. Where in the US, there was a Warren County movement, it's called. There was this one specific county, which was a predominantly black community. And then the state decided to dump some contaminated soil in that region. And then people started protesting. They were like, why? We don't want this soil. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, it was proven that this region was specifically selected because this was people who were poor and they were considered to have not so much power. So it was easy, like, okay, then we just dump this contaminated soil there because their lives don't matter so much. So this is the fucked up scenario where the social inequalities are then used to then dump environmental pollution on some groups, or only reserve environmental benefits for some privileged group. That's the idea of environmental racism.
It's kind of that this racism happens within countries and between countries, it seems.
Yeah, exactly.
You have like an internal colonization, one could say, and like the classical form of colonization between nations, right?
Yes.
So within nations, you have, for example, when it comes to pollutants like car pollutants, mm-hmm. And street noise. So the less well-off people live obviously at the streets that are more polluted, and the rich are not.
Yes, exactly.
And of course, when it comes to CO2 emissions and the effects of that between nations, there are also these stark differences.
And that's what we also see often now. The another case that we recently see is now that there's whole discussion about phasing out fossil fuels and carbon emissions, and now that the coal business is getting very difficult to sustain in some countries, in countries in global north, we see that different countries are now trying to force some countries in global south to open new coal power plants, whereas we don't need more coal power plants. These countries can easily switch to renewables. But instead, they are now these companies who are used to making money out of coal technology. They still want to make money, right? And these companies are often from Global North. And now they're trying to go to Africa, to Bangladesh, and saying, oh, you need some coal power plant. I have some good technology for you. And they're kind of forcing these countries to buy those. So this is like another scenario that we see that's happened in the last 10 years.
I kind of see three narratives right now. You already mentioned the eco-fascist narrative that strives for climate apartheid, one could say.
Yeah.
And there is like the, with a global justice approach, climate justice movement. And there is also like in the center of our societies, one could say, there is the story of green growth and making capitalism and markets greener.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered how you would describe these alternative narratives that are in play right now, and why do you support like the climate justice and especially the degrowth perspective, which is very skeptical when it comes to making capitalism greener and striving for green growth, right?
Yeah. I mean, the first answer is very simple. The climate crisis we are facing is because of capitalism, is because of the way we produce things and the way we value things at the moment, how our economy is run. It is at the core of the climate crisis. Because if we see, like, how come we reached here? Like, did anybody, if 50 years ago, 100 years ago, somebody told us that we humans will be the reason for threatening life on this planet, we wouldn't probably believe. But there were some people who predicted regarding the way we were going. And so the main reason, of course, this whole carbon emission, that's a technical part, right? But what I always say, the climate crisis, some tries to show it as just a technical chemistry, biochemical, environmental issue, but this is not a technical issue at all. Because if we see, we knew that this carbon emission is going to put us where we are. We already knew in by 1950, there was this Club of Rome report in 1970s, and they had this perfect prediction. Then how did we still arrive here? Because again, we see that this carbon emission has close links with this fossil fuel industry. And if you go back, we clearly see that this industry, each year they spend 200 million euros to lobby against climate policy, to support climate denial theories. So if you think about that, how could that happen? So these people, they had this power. They wanted to make sure their profit runs. And we have created a system where we have allowed for profit to be prioritized over well-being of people. And if you go behind, like if you start to dig deeper, how was that possible? It has always been that we created our economies in a way that we didn't care about people anymore. Our reason of production is not to make sure that everybody has enough to eat. The reason of our production is to make sure we make a lot of profit and we grow. Mm. And then where does this profit ends up? It always ends up in the hand of very few. And whenever it ends up with the hand of very few, they have a lot of power and they try to organize and design the whole planet just for their favor. And even today, if you look into how the rich are preparing, there are apparently some people who has bought lands in New Zealand, because apparently the prediction shows New Zealand would be less impacted by the sea level rise and changes. And they have tried to create some bunkers in those places. There are some people who are already preparing for climate apocalypse, and they try to even develop some security system where they try to predict how, even when everything is falling apart, how could they have food and they can make their security guards still work from them. So this kind of crazy, absurd things. And you see and you know, okay, so these people knew and they're still kind of prioritizing their own lives, and they are happy to have all the people die or something. So it kind of makes you feel a bit crazy and a bit dystopian. But then we realize that this whole capitalist system has been at the core of this crisis. And then we cannot go out of this without fundamentally talking about system change. We won't be able to solve this with green cars or just renewables, because it's way more than that. It's not only about reducing carbon emissions. It's about how we produce, how we distribute our production, and how we live on this planet, and what's our relationship with the nature.
Yeah, I perfectly agree with you. It's not only about technical solutions, but also changing the relations of people and our production. But I wonder, Tony, if you see a flaw there in the climate movement, at least when it comes to big players, for example, like Fridays for Future, maybe. Because it seems to me, at least, I'm not sure if I'm overcritical, but they're a lot concerned with technical viability studies, like the one they put out last year, and that's perfectly fine. Like how we can reduce carbon emissions with like renewable energies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But these viability studies don't actually tackle the question whether we need like this fundamental system change and how a post-growth society could work actually. How we organize our production, our consumption and stuff like that. And there's good reason to believe that it's not enough to just put out renewable energies, rebound effect, whatever, but that we actually need fundamental changes in how we live together and how we produce. So do you think we are not far enough when it comes to that and we should push more in that direction? Or what are your thoughts on that?
First of all, definitely we need to push far, way, way more far in that direction. And I think problem is what I always try to say that we need to go to 100. But if you're at zero, it's impossible. It's difficult to go from zero to 100, right? Mm. When choosing and deciding on our strategy of a battle, I like to always think that we have to be very radical in our analysis, but pragmatic in our implementation.
Good point.
And on that level, I mean, I absolutely agree. Even within the movement, there are different levels of what who believes what, right? But the problem is, even with the renewables, there's such a big fight. Like, even with that, we are having such difficulty to make that be accepted and passed. So I believe that there are these differences. So when we're engaging with people who are so far out, and then there who are still absolutely cannot even conceive how we can go towards a degrowth. So the first, I'm still kind of okay that, yeah, okay, you can still put out this very practical, like, yeah, even with that, if you wanted to technically solve this, this is the pathway, and we are not doing that. And I would want to engage with anybody who then is willing to, yeah, okay, maybe we can solve it with these ways, then kind of starting, yes, you think we can solve this, but how about this? Then kind of then pushing for the more radical ones. But, you know, so for from zero to go to 100, we have to go from 5, 10, 15, 20 at least. So and whoever is at 20, I'm willing to meet them at 20 and kind of bring them towards 100, kind of push them towards 30. So whoever is at 30, I would be wanting to push them towards 40. But it's very difficult to bring someone from zero to 100 in one step. So in that regard, I believe that we have to, in terms of our analysis, yeah, we have to make it, speak it again and again. Like, yeah, without degrowth, we cannot make it. And what would be then practical things? Then kind of creating more practical steps. What could be the steps towards that transition? And kind of, so we would need renewables, yes, but that is not the end all. So kind of then whoever thinks renewables is everything, yes, fine. It's good that you have your energy. Okay, let's try to do that. But you should be open. This is not the all. And kind of then also put them in their mind that, hey, these are the flaws in your analysis. Green car is not the solution. So I believe in terms of strategy, that's how we have to engage. And then at the same time, keep pushing this exactly what you said, that kind of making it clear why it doesn't, without degrowth, without radical changes, we won't be able to solve this or kind of go towards a more sustainable path. Does it make sense?
Totally. I think that's perfectly reasonable to kind of try to connect the practical and also a short-term thinking with the visionary thinking, because the degrowth scene is quite marginalized still. So we have to start at some point, I guess.
Yeah.
I wondered what you think about the Green New Deal narrative in that scenario, because I kind of feel that in Germany, at least, and also in Europe at large, maybe this is not pushed enough. I kind of think, at least when I compare it to the United States, where like the whole climate issue is connected to the Green New Deal narrative, like from a left political perspective, because this kind of speaks to this transformative passage and these issues of connecting social issues with a transformation into renewables, but also a more transformative passage towards a post-growth or a more planned, democratically planned economy.
I agree with you absolutely that it's a very different discussion here than the way, and I think it's also a bit challenging that somehow here it has been a super, I mean, I feel that it's also a bit blocking it, because now recently it has been a lot about this bike lanes and renewables and electric cars. And I didn't expect it to get so just that, but it looks like, also recently now with the election coming up in the case of Germany, it looks like everyone is kind of just being trying to be happy with that. And I think it's a bit shame. Like, I think we should probably try to kind of really engage different groups, like starting with, as you said, like different workers. There's, of course, criticism of Green New Deal as well. But at this point, there are several Green New Deals, and there are some are really radical and really good ones. There is one that was created, I don't know, by DiEM25 or something. There was this one proposal that was also quite good in many ways. It tried to address many different aspects. So, and there's also this one Green New Deal that the EU tried to come up with, right? And that is such a greenwashing. There has been a lot of criticism of that as well. So here I see like two things. Like one thing is there's a door opening, kind of people still saying that this is not enough. And there's another bigger chunk who are kind of moving towards that by saying that, okay, yeah, this is probably something that we need. Like from the corona, like the packages that came right after the corona crisis, we saw the huge amount of money that governments are willing to inject into the economy and trying to shape. And that kind of really shows what, when the governments are really sincere, what they could do and what they could come up with. It has been the ones that has been taken in Germany is really exemplary. And this kind of also shows the path that, okay, probably so if we could show people like, yeah, this is where we have to go. And I believe really that if there was not so much backdoor lobbying as well, probably against like to protect the fossil fuels, it would be probably much easier. And then the climate policy would come much faster. So on one hand, I think there is this power that we could really push that, yeah, through policy and then government willingness, it's really possible to go for something that ambitious. But on the other hand, I think many are not even being able to dream that big or be that brave and then kind of still be okay with the smaller bits and pieces. And I think if you were, that was your sublime message in between, like there's a lot of work to do in that area for the movement and the climate movement, but also the kind of enjoining a bit also, but maybe with the political different forces at this point, I feel.
Yeah, and right now I kind of feel that everybody is concerned with Corona anyways, and the climate issue is kind of driven to the side. But what Corona, from my point of view, also shows is that we need to think about economic safety when we think about the issue of changing our economy to make it viable in terms of the climate. And there I see some progress when Fridays for Future, for example, connects with unions in Germany, for example.
Yeah.
Because when there's economic hardship and capitalism, of course, in a crisis, there's less concern for issues like climate movement. And I guess you as an economist kind of also come from that direction.
Yeah. Like the main point is it's possible and there are quite a lot of alternative policies out there. And if you look into the history back in the days, we have seen how terrible economic policies has been rolled out. And because it favored the big multinationals, like the whole restructuring structural adjustment program that World Bank and IMF started rolling out from the 90s to a lot of the countries in Global South, Asia, Africa. Now, after 20 years, IMF ended up having to say that, yeah, that was terrible. It destroyed several countries' economies. And then they just did it. And now they're like, oops, sorry, we just destroyed some economies. And another side note that I was having this talk with a friend who was supporting Labour for the last UK election. And Labour had this very beautiful manifesto. And they had very well thought out plans. And even then, it was a bit disappointing maybe for many, I don't know, maybe for you as well. And then we're having like, what was the reason? There were many reasons. And one of the reasons was really, I heard from this friend, like people didn't believe it. Like for some of them, they really were like, yeah, it's so easy. And so all our misery doesn't have any meaning. Like people are also not willing to accept that. People are so used to and attached to their pain in a way. So when somebody even says that the governments could actually change things and it is possible, they believe, no, it cannot be true. They believe that you're bound to this miserable life. And then kind of the governments could take such responsibility and roll out policies that would change things for good. There's also this resistance towards this kind of belief. So I think there are also this another unexpected battle, I think, from our side we'd have to fight to kind of then really make people see how the lies that they've been told and kind of adjusted to. So I think this corona situation, if, let's see how it goes, but with a lot of these government packages, if it's possible to protect for a longer time, then it could open the doors of talking about how similar climate packages could come into place and really still, while protecting the economy, it's possible to go towards that shift. We just have to change the motivation and we have to change the intention, who we are trying to protect, who we are trying to support.
Yes, the great or not so great, depends on how you look at him. Winston Churchill said, never let a good crisis go to waste, right? We should use every opportunity to then fight for our issues. But yeah, Tony, I agree with you. It's kind of difficult, like after decades of neoliberalism and political apathy, to get through to people and to make your vision seem viable, right? But Tony, as an outlook, I just wondered regarding the local and global environmental racism that we talked about, the shortcomings of the climate movement that we talked about, and also the marginalized perspective of people of color like yourself within the climate movement and society at large. What do you think should be the path forward for the climate movement strategically in the next years? So especially like in this corona situation, which makes it even more difficult, right? So what do you think should be the way forward?
We should do a lot of organizing, like grassroots organizing, kind of really starting, because up to now, even it has been, we have been striking in front of different ministries. We have had some, only some ministers or some important political figures just talking to some Fridays for Future people, but it hasn't been really like a dialogue where people could convince their politicians. So I think we should really start creating discussion in the local community, like town, like village level, and really kind of mobilize a lot of discussion around climate and then kind of put that into the agenda of local councillor and then your local parliamentarian and whoever. So it's kind of bringing it a lot into the politics. I think that would be one. The second thing would be to start working a way more cross-sectional one. This amazing example you gave, like the Fridays for Future working with the labor unions. And there was some example of in Fridays for Future Heidelberg, they did the strike jointly with the United Colors of Change. So kind of working from a intersectional perspective. So I think that would be another very important point to really build a intersectional movement where you kind of push, because for a broader social change, we need that kind of collective action and solidarity amongst the movements. So connecting the movements. And the third thing then really would be starting like making this policy alternatives to make it more common in people's minds so that they also start thinking, yes, why not? Like, for example, again, when we talk about 30 hours work week, like, when we talk, why do we need to work so much? Why could we not go to a reduction work hour? So universal basic income. So these kind of ideas, which would be absolutely necessary for the kind of change we want. And then for example, safe passageway for migration. Safe migration passage should be a normal common sense thing. It shouldn't make people think, oh my God, the zombies are coming. So once we can really make these discussions common and make people understand what it means or that it's possible. So to take away that fear of not understanding, but rather realizing that, okay, that is this, that is how the future could look like. And this is actually a good thing for all of us. So that would be the third thing, to really make this alternative policies more present in people's perception, kind of acceptable, and make like a common sense, like be like, yeah, really, it makes sense. Why are we not doing it? And I think that that would create a lot of ground to then really push. So when we really are in a position to roll out those policies, it would be much more possible. So I would say this would be like the three kind of things to aim for.
Just one afterthought regarding political action. Do you see any privileged way of doing climate activism, like, for example, striving more for radical civil disobedience style politics like Ende Gelände, for example, or more on the other side, reformists like going into parliamentary politics? Do you see there we should like prioritize any of these two, or don't you make a difference?
I would say actually we need all of it, because as I was saying, like we need unprecedented levels of collaboration. And I think we need everything. We need like we need to push everyone to reach the most radical spectrum that they could. So we need a lot of young people in the parliament. So even the ones who thinks, yeah, we don't need so much civil disobedience, we can change things once we are in the system. And I really want this young, good-hearted people to be able to go into the parliament, and once they're then, and then to be disillusioned and really see that how system actually changes you and what are the obstacles? Because I have heard from many people, like, being on the street helps. When there is people power on the street, that also helps the people who is inside these structures, these policymakers, to also push for a radical reform, because they can say, look, people are on the street. This is us, on us. We really have to do something. So I think we really need whoever, all these people on all these different stages of power and on the street, as radical as they can get. So we need a lot of young people on the parliaments who believes this is what they think they can do. Yes, please go try. We need people on the streets. I think Indie Gelände has a lot of power. So there is a, it has changed, like, starting from 2015. If you see how, I mean, of course, one would say we still didn't get the carbon phase out, like 2038. And so in that regard, we didn't achieve, one could say, anything. But on the other hand, if you see how much power in terms of the vision and how much in terms of demand it has created, and the people's mind as well, like a struggle, what it means, it has, I would say, it's very powerful. So we also need those kind of a lot of radical actions, and we also need in between. So I think we really need, like, a lot of large scale. So because where we are at, we cannot just aim for one or two things. We need the grandmas to get as radical as they can. We need the teachers to get as radical as they can. We need parliamentarians to get as, so I would say I would want for everybody, and kind of like this push to towards the most radical you can get, and let's see what we can do all together.
Tony, thank you so much for joining me on the Dissens podcast. It was a pleasure.
It was. I enjoyed a lot talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, das war der Dissens-Podcast für diese Woche. Schön, dass ihr dabei wart. Zu Gast war Toni Noschen. Sie ist Wirtschaftswissenschaftlerin und Klimaaktivistin. Schaut mal in die Shownotes, da findet ihr weitere Infos zu ihrer Person. Und was ihr dort auch findet, sind ein paar wichtige Infos zu den Veranstaltungen für die Ermordeten des rassistischen Terroranschlags von Hanau vor genau einem Jahr. Am 19. Februar jährt sich dieses furchtbare Hassverbrechen, und es gibt Kundgebungen, Demos und Gedenkveranstaltungen in ganz vielen Städten. Schaut doch mal, ob eure Stadt da dabei ist. Denn es ist wichtig, denke ich, dass wir die 9 Menschen, die da ermordet wurden aus rassistischen Motiven, dass wir die nicht vergessen, dass wir an sie erinnern und dass wir zeigen, dass wir wütend sind und dass wir wollen, dass sich so etwas nicht wiederholt. Ja, sagt ihre Namen. Willi Viorel-Paun, Sedat Gürbüz, Fatih Sarajoglu, Ferhat Unvar, Gökhan Gültekin, Mercedes Kirpacz, Kaloyan Velkov, Hamza Kurtovic und Said Nessa Hashemi. Das sind die 9 Menschen, die vor einem Jahr am 19. Februar 2020 von einem Rassisten ermordet wurden. Und heute, ein Jahr später, muss es heißen, kein Zurück zur Tagesordnung. Rassismus ist ein Problem, das uns alle angeht. Und damit es keinen nächsten Anschlag gibt, müssen wir fucking laut sein, damit sich was ändert in diesem Land. Ja, das war's dann auch von mir an dieser Stelle. Mir bleibt nur noch zu sagen, passt auf euch auf, und wir hören uns dann nächste Woche.